This is the Mormon Expression Podcast. Find us on the web at mormonexpression.com.
Okay, welcome back to another episode of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. Welcome again to our panel. First of all, we have George and Tom, who are active members.
Hello, everybody. Nice to be back. This is George.
Yeah, this is Tom. What's up, guys?
And, of course, we have our ex-Mormons, Niall and James.
Hello.
This is Niall.
And the lovely Zilpha will be joining us again.
Hello.
If the debate between Mormon critics and defenders is compared to a battle, the Book of Abraham is ground zero. On the one hand, it is possibly Joseph's crowning work. It shows a developed and creative theology that introduces some of the most distinctive Mormon doctrines. On the other, it could be the smoking gun that critics need to indict Joseph as an imposter. The debate between the critics and the apologists can get very technical, and today we are going to try to sort it out. On this podcast, we will focus on an introduction to the issues surrounding the Book of Abraham, including its history and a roadmap of the controversies. To help us out, we have brought on a guest panelist who knows his way around the issue. Our guest panelist today, Chris Smith, was introduced to Mormonism in the time-honored way he started to date a Mormon girl. Chris never joined the church, but this encounter began a lifelong interest in Mormonism. Chris received his bachelor's degree in biblical studies from Fresno Pacific University and an MA in Christian history from Wheaton College. This fall, Chris will begin a PhD program in Christian history at Claremont under the renowned Mormon historian Richard Bushman. Chris has presented papers at conferences on various subjects, including one at Sunstone West this year on the Book of Abraham papyri. He has also presented a paper on the Egyptian alphabet and grammar slated for publication in the John Whitmer Historical Society Journal this fall. Chris, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you, John. Good to be here.
Great. Now, why don't you just go ahead and get us started with the Book of Abraham. What in the world is the Book of Abraham?
Okay, well, the Book of Abraham is a book of scripture that Joseph Smith translated from some Egyptian papyri that were sold to him by a traveling showman in 1835. And it's really the only Book of Mormon scripture where Joseph Smith translated from a source text that didn't get taken away by an angel. In it. In other words, it's the only one where we still have an extant source text from which it was translated, which allows us, obviously, the possibility to verify or disconfirm Joseph Smith's translation of it. And that really is why it's such a hot-button and really significant issue for evaluating the church's truth claim.
Okay, well, probably the first question that I have is, why are you interested in the Book of Mormon or Book of Abraham at all?
Well, like I said, it's obviously the one place Joseph's claims can really be verified. It's also just a really interesting subject to me because I think it gives us a window into Joseph Smith's process of receiving revelations and his self-understanding as a prophet. Of course, these papyri are full of really cool pictures, and so you can look at the ways that Joseph Smith interpreted those pictures. And we have these great documents called Kirtland Egyptian Papers, like the Egyptian Alphabet and Grammar, where we can actually see the process by which Joseph's reflection on these papyri unfolded and his theology, his understanding of them unfolded over time. I mean, the Egyptian alphabet and grammar, it evolved. There were several stages during which this document was created, and it's fascinating evolution. It seems like Joseph Smith is really reflecting on these documents and almost spouting off the top of his head, giving sort of a creative, imaginative account of what these symbols mean based on their shapes and the morphology of the characters. Like, for example, an upside-down question mark he interprets as an interrogative pronoun, or a little man with his hands raised he interprets as an expression of joy or supplication. It's almost as though you see this process of suggestion that's leading Joseph Smith to make intuitive leaps. And I just think that's fascinating to look at because I think it illuminates how the revelatory process worked for Joseph Smith.
Okay, now at the time that Joseph Smith translated these, the reading and writing of Egyptian was not very common. Is that correct?
That's very correct. Of course, Champollion had recently made his breakthrough discovery and how to interpret Egyptian, but that really was not well known in the United States. Even though it had been published, some people had were aware of Champollion's discovery, there was nobody in the United States who had even a remote knowledge who could even begin to interpret these documents. So it must have seemed to Joseph Smith like he was relatively safe offering an interpretation. There wasn't anybody in that day who was going to challenge him on what he was saying. And you also have to realize that it was traditional to think of Egyptian as a symbolic, an ideographic language. Hieroglyphs were supposed to be these mystical symbols that were self-contained ideas in their own right. Each symbol was a pictographic representation of some big idea. And so people saw them as mystical, that they could contain huge amounts of meaning, rich, rich meaning. Well, Champollion's idea was that this is actually a syllabic script. It's consonantal, meaning that it's phonetic. Several characters will make up a word just like in English. You use the English alphabet to spell out a word. And Joseph Smith reflects the old understanding of Egyptian. He's looking at these characters as mystical symbols and interpreting them that way.
Chris, this is Jim. I am wondering what the significance of Egyptology and the study of Egyptian history was in 1835. I know people like Aleister Crowley and the Atlanteans kind of furthered, you know, Egyptology, you know, in the 1920s here in America. But in 1835, I mean, how common was it to talk about Egypt and discuss, you know, these things in a kind of mystical fashion?
Yeah, I think it was really very common, maybe more common than has been suggested, some have suggested, but less common than some have suggested. But certainly Egypt was a fascinating culture, and when you see a lot of Egyptian elements in Freemasonry, the Romantic poets like Emerson just loves to talk about hieroglyphs and Egyptian stuff as though they're sort of these mystical windows into divine truths. And so I think that people were fascinated by Egypt, but they didn't have a lot of hard historical data about Egypt. And that really fed the fascination, I think, because there's something that's mysterious that Joseph Smith can almost say anything about, and nobody's going to be able to call his bluff, so to speak.
Chris, this is George. I have a question for you about when then in American kind of history societies did an interest start arising in this area of the world and its history, because I'm just thinking about all the movies that I've watched over the years, and you know, like The Mummy and areas like that where you think of things that have come out of Hollywood. You think that at some point the historical societies in the country started picking up on this. Was this in the late 1800s or early 1900s? In other words, when did the expertise start coming into the United States?
Egypt was fascinating for a long time, but I think that the thing that sort of the watershed moment in history when people started studying Egypt in more detail was when Napoleon conquered Egypt, because of course they're plundering the Egyptian monuments and tombs and bringing all this stuff back to Europe to study. But that doesn't really make its way into America until I think the latter half of the 19th century. The first half of the 19th century, you get some speculation, you get some sort of pseudoscience, people who actually are challenging Champollion's theory and still holding on to that old symbolic interpretation. So you have people studying Egypt but not really doing a good job of it, I think, until the latter half of the 19th century.
Okay, so the connection for Joseph Smith and Egypt didn't come about with the Book of Abraham, because that stuff shows up way early in the Book of Mormon.
That's exactly right. In fact, one of the things that I argue in my paper that will be published this fall in the John Whitmer Journal is that the idea for an Egyptian alphabet and grammar originated with the Book of Mormon. It did not originate with the Book of Abraham. In Lucy Mack Smith's preliminary draft of her history, she talks about how when Martin Harris took the transcript with the Book of Mormon characters to Charles Anton, the goal was to create an Egyptian alphabet so that Joseph Smith could then proceed from there and use that in translating the Book of Mormon. And so I think that later, when the Book of Abraham rolls around, he's actually adapting that idea and using that in translating the Book of Abraham.
Clearly, the idea that the Egyptian language could somehow compact more ideas into smaller scribble space existed early on, because that's the whole justification for Lehi, who was, by implication, a Hebrew speaker, would write this book passed on to Nephi in the Egyptian language.
That's absolutely right. Joseph Smith used the word comprehensive to describe both the Book of Mormon characters and the Book of Abraham characters. He's talking about these symbols as sort of extremely densely packed with meaning. And Oliver Cowdery says that sometimes Book of Mormon characters were translated as whole pieces of English. And then, of course, in the Book of Abraham, we get a single character that can be translated almost as two paragraphs of English text. So, yeah, that idea was definitely there. And Joseph Smith definitely made a connection between the Book of Mormon characters and the Book of Abraham characters. One of the first things that they do when Chandler arrives in Kirtland with these papyri is they bring him a transcript with the Book of Mormon characters on it, and they compare it and say, look how similar they are.
This is George. I'd never heard this part of it. Could you delve into that just a little bit more in detail when Chandler does show up and they bring him? What portion of the Book of Mormon did they bring to him to compare with the papyri?
Well, we don't really know, but presumably it was the Anton transcript or something like it. There's few documents that have characters from the Book of Mormon written on them. F.G. Williams had a copy of some Book of Mormon characters. Oliver Cowdery had a copy of some Book of Mormon characters. There's, of course, the Anton transcript and then the published handbill that has the Anton transcript characters on it. So it could have been any of those, but the main point there is that Joseph Smith clearly saw the Book of Mormon and the Book of Abraham as related projects and the languages as related languages.
How similar in style and form is the Hebrew and the Egyptian styles? Are they similar at all in look and feel?
Not really, no. They're fairly different. But Joseph Smith did... there are a couple eyewitness reports that suggest that Joseph said there was a little bit of Hebrew on the three. So I think maybe he's looking at some Egyptian character and saying, look, this looks similar to this Hebrew letter. And, of course, in the Egyptian alphabet and grammar, the symbol for Beth, the Hebrew letter B, he actually names that one of the Egyptian symbols based on its similarity to the Hebrew letter. So he's making some connections there as well, but in a more limited way.
How similar were the characters that he said were from the Book of Mormon to Egyptian characters?
Characters on the Anton transcript and the other documents that we have are not Egyptian characters.
Okay.
If there's an ancient language that those characters actually correspond to, we don't know about it today.
And it's not very similar at all to Egyptian.
No, it's not.
You could not call it Reformed Egyptian, then?
No, I don't think so. I mean,
okay.
They might have called it that because they didn't know any better. But today, I think if you took that transcript to an Egyptologist and said, does this look like it could be Reformed Egyptian, he would say absolutely not.
So now, my understanding is most apologists say that Reformed Egyptian is a heretofore undiscovered language, correct? They don't try to equate it with, say, demonic or any other sort of Egyptian writing.
No, and I think that they would put demotic and hieratic as instances of Reformed Egyptian kinds of languages. In other words, that they would say that those show that people were experimenting with different ways of writing hieroglyphics, maybe some shorthand ways of writing hieroglyphics, but they would not point to those as the Book of Mormon language. They would say that the Book of Mormon language is a completely sort of separate permutation of the Egyptian language, and one that we have no examples of today.
Hey, Chris, this is Niall. What are the main problems with the Book of Abraham? Why is this something that every faithful member of the church should be scared? To me, it seems like it's a slam dunk. What's your take on that?
I think there are several problems. The first is simply the problem that when they rediscovered the papyri in the 1950s, they found that the papyri were fairly commonplace Egyptian funerary documents that didn't have anything to do with Abraham. So that's problem number one. The source text does not match up with the translation. Problem number two is the Egyptian alphabet and grammar, which, of course, is not an authentic Egyptian. I mean, it doesn't actually translate anything in an Egyptological sense. It gets just about everything wrong. And then problem number three is that there's the Book of Abraham text. There's problems with the Book of Abraham text. For example, the Chaldeans would not have a recognizable people in the time of Abraham. The Chaldeans show up much, much later, around like 600 BC, which is far too late to be contemporary with Abraham. And so you can look at the Book of Abraham and say, well, there's things here that seem to come from Joseph Smith's immediate experience, from his study of Hebrew, from his study of the Bible and Josephus, but there's nothing here that looks like it comes from an ancient text about Abraham, and so that's another problem.
Hey, Chris. This is Tom, by the way. What about the two questions or the two responses that apologists most often get, which is from Professor Gee, I believe, who's a professor at BYU, who says that, well, there's a lot of missing documents from the Book of Abraham. Yeah, we have some existing, but there's several feet or yards that are missing from the existing document. That leaves that question unanswered. And then the second, why not the existing documents that we have for the Book of Abraham be the catalyst that actually caused Joseph Smith to receive the revelation, which is what the Book of Abraham is today?
To the first question about, so why not a missing papyri? The Kirtland Egyptian papers, if you look at the translation manuscripts of the Book of Abraham, they actually have in the left-hand margin the characters from which the Book of Abraham is translated, the characters that correspond to the English text. And in fact, sometimes Joseph Smith writes little numbers next to those characters, or his scribes, rather, write little numbers next to those characters, and then corresponding numbers in the English text to show which text goes with which character. And so those characters in the margins actually come sequentially from one of the fragments that the church has today. And so just on the face of it, it certainly looks like that fragment of papyrus is the source of the Book of Abraham text that we have. Now, there is missing papyrus. Probably my estimate is about half the collection is missing. John Gee would put that figure much, much higher. But we have most of the important parts, most of the parts that Joseph Smith interpreted to eyewitnesses and in his published revelations, we have today.
Chris, I think one of the most common responses to connection of the ideographs with the corresponding paragraphs that you're talking about, I've read somewhere that Bibley or somebody said that the ideograph was added after, so that they don't actually correspond. What would you say to that?
Right, Nibley, actually, Gee, I believe, is the one who made that argument. And he based it on the claim that the Egyptian characters in one place actually overrun the English text, meaning it's clear that the Egyptian character is written over the English text. And actually, that claim was not correct. And he also claimed that there were, it's clearly different inks, the characters written in different inks from the English text, and that's also not correct. And I think that's because he was working maybe with bad photographs of them, that just the colors were not clear. But in any case, there is no positive reason to believe that, and I think there are reasons not to believe that. The first of which is that in both the Egyptian alphabet and grammar and the other manuscripts that we have from Kirtland, the characters are always written first and then the translation is added later. And so presumably the same thing is happening in the Book of Abraham translation manuscripts. Secondly, in some of the Book of Abraham translation manuscripts, you get several characters written, and then you can see the margin in the English text actually widens in order to accommodate the characters. So you can see the characters are being added before the corresponding text as they're sort of going along in these manuscripts.
What would you say to the criticism that these ideographs and then the corresponding texts are just uninspired attempt to literally translate it? Or maybe a brainstorming session. What would you say about that?
I think that the claim usually bandied around is that the Egyptian characters were added as sort of an attempt to reverse engineer the Egyptian alphabet and grammar from the translation. And my answer to that actually will be published in the fall, and you can read about it. The title of my character is, or my paper is, The Dependence of Abraham 1:1-3 on Alphabet and Grammar. And I make some text critical arguments and some historical arguments that basically the direction of dependence between those documents is not one of the grammar being reverse engineered from the translation, but of the scribes actually using the grammar to produce the final Book of Abraham translation. And I think you can see that if you look at Abraham 1:1-3, it doesn't flow very well. It looks like somebody's taken a bunch of dictionary entries and just sort of cobbled them together almost mechanically. You can see all these appositives. He'll interpret a character and then say or even and give another interpretation for that same character and give four or five in sequence like that. And that's because in those first three verses, it's sort of the most mechanical, most thoroughgoing attempt to translate the Book of Abraham using the Egyptian alphabet and grammar as a sort of translation dictionary.
So did he kind of change tactics as the translation went forward?
Yeah, there are some places in the rest of the Book of Abraham where you can look and say, this character is translated in the translation manuscripts the same way that it's translated in the Egyptian alphabet and grammar.
From a purely mechanical standpoint, the Book of Abraham is translated differently chapter to chapter, even.
Yeah. The first three verses are clearly from the Egyptian alphabet and grammar. And then you get down through about chapter 2, verse 18, and in that section, you get sort of a more loose dependency on the Egyptian alphabet and grammar. There's like a few verses that are taken from the Egyptian alphabet and grammar, but most of it appears to be sort of dictated on the spot. And then for the remainder of the Book of Abraham, I don't think the alphabet and grammar played any role whatsoever. That's translated much later in Nauvoo, and the Egyptian alphabet project is sort of in the past, and Joseph Smith isn't doing the same thing anymore.
So, Chris, this is George. One of the things that I'm thinking about as I'm listening to this last explanation, one of the apologist arguments that I read this afternoon talked about the papyri served as inspiration and got him started in the revelation process. And what you indicated now just kind of sounds like that could be us. If he started reading, translating verses 1 through 3 of chapter 1 and got very analytical and tried to get going one way, could that have inspired him or given him a methodology and a thought process and allowed him to be inspired or have an idea flow process that he could have received the rest of this by revelation?
You know, I really, I don't have a problem with the catalyst theory. In fact, I, when I presented my paper at Sunstone West on the missing papyrus theory, one of the things that I said was, if you go with the catalyst theory, you have something that basically accords with most of the historical evidence, in the sense that it's clear that Joseph Smith is looking at the shape of the characters and is looking at the pictures on the papyrus, and drawing conclusions from those and sort of intuitively reflecting on those. And that is informing his process of bringing forth these revelations. And so, you know, if you want to say that, Joseph Smith is receiving this from God, then I'm fine with that. And if you want to say that Joseph Smith is using his imagination and his intuition, then I'm fine with that too. I think either of those can be the process by which this happened.
I'm sorry, could you just do a definition clarification? You said this catalyst theory. Could you, I think I know what you're meaning by that, but could you just quickly define that for us?
Yeah, the catalyst theory, I think there's a few different permutations of it, but basically the bottom line is the papyrus served as a visual catalyst for Joseph Smith to receive revelation. And that could mean that he's receiving a historical narrative about Joseph Smith or about the Abraham, or it could mean that he's receiving a sort of inspired fiction or almost producing a revelation more than receiving it by reflecting on these images.
I'm sorry, I have a problem with that catalyst theory because Joseph Smith was claiming to be translating, literally translating the document. He said it was written by Abraham by his own hands. How does that turn into a catalyst?
That's absolutely right. And in fact, the catalyst theorists would say that Joseph Smith had no idea what he was doing. He actually didn't understand the process by which he was bringing forth these revelations. And so, you know, you have to live with a certain amount of cognitive dissonance if you're going to adopt that theory.
Now, Joseph Smith had produced the Book of Moses earlier, and I understand that he didn't have any artifact that he riffed on to get that thing. It was just pure revelation, I suppose, if you want to take it that route.
Yeah, there are apologists who have tried to apply that same principle to the Book of Abraham and say, well, Joseph Smith just translated something that he didn't have. But obviously that doesn't fit with Joseph Smith's understanding of what he was doing. And it also doesn't really fit with the fact that the text of the Book of Abraham clearly is based on the facsimiles. There are clear references and allusions to the facsimiles in the Book of Abraham narrative. Like, for example, it refers to the four idol gods and to the couch shaped like a lion, and the priest of Pharaoh sacrificing Abraham. I mean, it's clearly, the Book of Abraham text clearly responds to those images. And so I don't think you could say that the Book of Abraham was sort of translated from some text that Joseph Smith didn't have, because that doesn't explain the relationship between the documents that we have.
So, Chris, when I read chapter 1, and I get to verse 12, and it actually says, I refer you to the representation of the commencements of this record, which is clearly facsimile 1. Yeah. I have a really hard time, and this is from a member's perspective, supporting the catalyst theory. It seems like the catalyst theory is so easy to not accept, because he's clearly referring back to this presentation, and then you go back to the explanation, you read the explanations of figures 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and those have clearly been shown by the Egyptologists to be wrong. How does the catalyst have any weight or keep going within the apologist community?
Well, the catalyst theory, you have to understand, is a very liberal Mormon kind of take. I mean, this is a theory that almost assumes that Joseph Smith is engaged in a poetic and a creative process rather than a literal translation of anything. You know, the catalyst theorist would simply say, well, Joseph Smith is putting that in there, and that's not, those aren't the words of Abraham, those are the words of Joseph Smith in this sort of modern fictional revelation.
Okay, Chris, to that point, I mean, to take it a little step further, I guess, is, okay, so Joseph Smith got a lot of things wrong. We've obviously exhausted that, but what about the things that he got right?
Okay. He certainly pointed out quite a few parallels to ancient Abrahamic legends and traditions. The problem with what Nibley did is that he is drawing on, like, Muslim traditions from the 6th century AD and, you know, apocryphal Christian traditions from the 1st and 2nd centuries. And there's not really any reason to believe that these documents have any accurate historical information about Abraham in them. And he's drawing from such a wide historical panorama that, you know, it's hard to say that you could pin the Book of Abraham down to one time frame and say, well, this looks like a first century document, or this looks like a Muslim tradition. And I think that the apologists have presented arguments that refer to documents from all of those periods. And so my question is, if you can find parallels between the Book of Abraham and almost anything in the ancient world, then probably these parallels are more a product of either common sources, like they have common sources in the Bible, or just the ingenuity of the apologist and the coincidence between any text.
Yeah, Chris, you know, that was one thing that kind of shocked me when I was falling away from the church and grasping at apologetics to keep my faith was, you know, I ran to Nibley, you know, to regain my testimony of the Book of Abraham, but, you know, came away deluded because, you know, he was, you know, citing the, you know, Teutonic faith and other, you know, historical context that he was just grasping at things and just pulling from here and grabbing from there and saying, you know, look, because this has a parallel somewhere else, that means that, you know, I just proved my case. It seemed very, very desperate.
Yeah. I think that very much captures the problem with Nibley. I was reading in his Traditions in the Early Life of Abraham, or rather in Abraham in Egypt today to prepare for this podcast, and he makes the comment that the pseudepigrapha are called pseudo because they're not in the Bible. And I thought, that's not what pseudepigrapha means. Pseudepigrapha means that it wasn't written by who it claims to be written by. It was, a forgery, basically. It was written falsely in the name of some ancient person. You know, Nibley's drawing on these pseudepigraphal works, which are, you know, first and second century forgeries, either Gnostic forgeries or sort of Hellenistic Jewish forgeries with a theological agenda. And he's claiming that these give us accurate historical information about Abraham that verifies the information we find in the Book of Abraham. Well, no. The pseudepigraphal authors are responding to the same issues in the biblical text that Joseph Smith was responding to. Like, for example, when it says in Genesis that Abraham had gotten souls in Haran, when he leaves Haran, he brings all the souls he had gotten there with him. Well, the Joseph Smith and the apocryphal authors are drawing the same conclusion. Means Abraham was an evangelist and he won all these souls in Haran through his evangelism. Whereas in the original Hebrew text, probably what it meant was simply that Abraham had purchased slaves or servants or something like that in Haran and brought all of those with him, all his laborers and workmen. So anyway, some of the parallels, I think, amount to basically common sources in the Bible and common sort of apologetic approaches to difficult biblical texts.
Hey, Chris.
Yeah.
This is Niall. How do apologists account for the Book of Abraham being attached somehow to a funerary text?
That's an excellent question, and it's one that they don't really deal with. John Gee has, tried to identify examples of funerary texts that have other kinds of texts attached. Like, for example, there's some funerary texts that have temple rituals attached to them. But, of course, the problem with that is that when you have funerary texts with temple rituals on them, it's because the temple rituals are serving a funerary function. There are some cases where there are, an unrelated text written on the front side of the papyrus, and then the priests recycled that papyrus by writing a funerary document on the backside and then interning it with a dead person. But in the case of the Book of Abraham papyri, the funerary documents are on the front side. And, if you're burying this with a dead body, then you're not going to have the opportunity to recycle and reuse the papyrus by writing something different on the backside. So, I don't think it's plausible at all that this funerary papyrus would have a completely unrelated Jewish text on it. That just doesn't strike me as a reasonable proposal.
Chris, are there any other precedents for Jewish scripts or Jewish legend or any sort of Hebrew writings showing up in the Egyptian archaeological record?
Yeah, there was a fairly sizable Jewish community in Egypt, particularly Alexandria. In fact, a lot of the most interesting Jewish and Christian theology of the first few centuries AD came out of Alexandria. But, you're talking about a period much, much earlier. Abraham was actually before there was a recognizable nation of Israel. And so certainly at that time there were Canaanites who lived in Egypt. There were Canaanites who were slaves in Egypt. So it's certainly plausible that Abraham might have been there.
As I understand it, the apologists explain the reason why the document doesn't date back to the time of Abraham is that it was sort of a passed down document, recopied and recycled and like that. Are there any other examples of the text anywhere at all?
Well, obviously there are no other examples of the text from the ancient world, or that would be a slam dunk for the apologetic case. There are certainly no other texts that even really resemble this. The ones that the apologists point to as parallels are clearly composed later than the first century BC. And so if there's any, sort of tradition or historical validity to those texts, it's because they're drawing on earlier things, most notably the biblical tradition.
How likely is it that a document could survive intact, being copied down several times, and there being no other copies available?
Well, it wouldn't be the first time, I don't think, but it's a stretch. I think it really it depends more on the actual textual and historical evidence. I don't think I'd want to speculate on the likelihood that that there was or could have been such a text and hang my case on that. I think that the historical and textual evidence is really where we need to put our energy.
Yeah, I mean, given the text, it's like, starting with, the Great Gatsby and ending up with A Tale of Two Cities, it's just too wide of a different type of text. The finished product has nothing to do with Abraham, I think is the point that, the apologists like to dance around.
Yeah. If you look at the texts from Abraham's time period, this really doesn't have any resemblance at all to texts from that time period. They can point to texts from the first and second century that it has similarities to. You know, like the pre-existence was a fairly common Hellenistic idea. So in the Hellenistic period, you get Abraham legends that talk about pre-existence. The idea of pre-existence was not known in the time of Abraham. I mean, that came much later. The texts that they claim resemble the Book of Abraham are not from the right time period at all.
Chris, could you maybe touch on the, you know, when Joseph Smith had the papyri, they were already kind of fragmented, and so for the facsimiles, he had to kind of redraw in some portions, and especially the guy that stands above Abraham with the knife.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that and what Joseph Smith did with it, and maybe what it should have been, or if we have other examples of the same kind of picture in other Egyptian papyri?
Sure. Of course, you're exactly right. The papyri were already damaged. They came to Joseph Smith, and the condition that they're in today is a little bit more damaged than what Joseph Smith had, but generally speaking, it's in more or less the same condition today that it was when Joseph Smith had it. The issue of the knife is significant because there are really no other cases of a funerary papyrus where Anubis is holding a knife. And so if there was a knife in this image, the apologist could then claim that this image is unique and that it's not a common funerary image, and that in fact, you know, maybe it's supposed to be interpreted as a priest standing over Abraham with a knife. There is a case on the walls of one of the ancient Egyptian temples where Anubis is holding a knife, and it's a kind of a mummification scene where he's mummifying some body. But that would be very unusual. And so what John Gee does is he looks at the eyewitness evidence. And there's a couple eyewitnesses that refer to an image. They saw an image where a priest was holding a knife. And so Gee says that there was a knife in Joseph Smith's day, and we can tell from these eyewitnesses because they didn't mention the absence of a knife. And the problem with that is that if these eyewitnesses are hearing Joseph Smith give them interpretations as they're viewing the papyri, then Joseph Smith is going to tell them this is a priest with a knife standing over Abraham, and that's what they're going to report, and that's what they're going to remember. The absence of a knife, I don't think, is significant or important enough that we should expect all of the eyewitnesses to come out and say, well, the knife was missing. That's kind of an unreasonable expectation from your eyewitnesses. And if you look at the contours of the damage on the papyri, you get these repeating patterns of damage because when the text was torn, it was rolled up. And so, you know, a chunk was torn out from the end, and then that same damage extends across all of the wrapping. And so if you look at the repeating contours of damage, it strongly suggests that there was no knife because that same pattern is repeated in all the successive wrapping.
Okay, well, what about the body of the priest compared to the head? Because it seems like they're different colors. Is that right?
The head, according to Egyptologists, should be a jackal's head because this is the Egyptian god Anubis. And the apologist will say, well, it was a priest. Normally, you would have a priest who was dressed up as Anubis. He'd wear an Anubis mask. And there are some cases where you get an Anubis figure with a human head because it's the depiction of the priest. But probably in the original papyrus, it was an Anubis head and not a human head.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, hey, Chris, I don't want to transition this too much, but I am curious about your motive. I mean, I guess that John insinuated at the beginning that the reason why you even got involved in Mormonism was because of a girl. Is that correct?
Yeah. I dated the bishop's daughter when I was in high school and picked up a copy of Leonard Arrington's The Mormon Experience off of my dad's library shelf and read the first chapter about Joseph Smith and got hooked, because here's the official historian of the Mormon Church talking about how Joseph Smith used his seer stones to hunt for buried treasure, and I just thought it was fascinating that Mormonism had such a sort of interesting, troubled history. And then as I studied it more, you know, the girl fell out of the picture, but I continued to make a hobby of studying Mormonism just because I think the history is so fascinating. And it's been a hobby to this day. And I'm actually, going to be studying Mormonism for my PhD. So that's, I think, attests to how fascinating I find this faith.
Chris, just a question. Were you pressured to be baptized?
To a certain degree, yeah. I actually attended Mormon seminary for 6 months while I was in high school.
What were they studying the year that you attended?
Doctrine and Covenant.
So not only were you there for an interesting part of history, but it was the part of history that would eventually become your hobby as well.
Yeah. And so, you know, at the end of that period, the seminary teacher came to me and asked me what was stopping me from getting baptized. And I said, well, there's a lot of things, but one that I mentioned to her was the priesthood ban. And so she said she didn't know anything about that, but she went and read up on it. And then the next day she came to me again and said that she had read up on it. And if Brigham Young would say those things, then she could understand why it would be a problem for me. And I said, he did say those things. I've checked on it myself. And then I sort of commented that some Mormons even today say that the reason that blacks were cursed pertaining to the priesthood was because they were less valiant in the pre-existence, and this was a punishment for the way they had behaved in the pre-existence. And she said, yeah, that's kind of what I believe. And I thought, great, I've indoctrinated my seminary teacher with Bruce McConkie's racist nonsense. I didn't go back after that.
So Chris, are you religious now? Did you join a congregation of any sort? Or
I was raised evangelical, Pentecostal, and so I have always been religious, and I continue to be religious, although in a much less conservative way than I used to. I have theologically liberalized a great deal.
So as an evangelical or Pentecostal, I would wonder if one of the reasons that you're actually going down this route is not just out of interest and hobby. Is there any kind of a desire to try and bring the LDS church down or anything like that? Or, I mean, I'm just trying to figure out what your motivation is.
No, I'm not interested in converting Mormons. I'm not interested in converting anybody. I have a vested interest, I guess, in sort of my own liberal views on religion. And so, wherever I encounter extremely dogmatic, rigid, fundamentalist attitudes about anything, I challenge attitudes because I think that they can be harmful. You won't see me out there sort of actively chanting at the temple anti-Mormon slogans or going door to door trying to stump people or stump the Mormon missionaries or anything like that. That's really not my interest. And in fact, I deeply respect people with conservative faith. And I really only want to communicate these dangerous, difficult ideas to people who feel prepared and want to learn them. I'm not out there hunting for people to share these ideas with. I think that they have to.
Hey, Chris. One last thing. Do you think that this whole topic, this book of Abraham and the translation, all these things, do you think it's actually a legitimate, literal problem for believing members? Do you think that it's a problematic thing that could cause believing members to stop believing?
It was for me.
It's a problem for a lot of people. Thomas Ferguson, this was a major cause for his loss of faith. But I think also that if people, rather than switching from an extremely literal interpretation of their faith to no belief in their faith whatsoever, if they can move toward a less literal understanding, to understanding their faith as metaphor and symbol, that they don't have to drop out of their religion entirely. They can retain the things that are beautiful about their faith without feeling like they have to abandon everything.
Is this the smoking gun?
I certainly think it is. I can't think of any issue in Latter-day Saint history that is more problematic than this one.
Yeah, I remember when I was leaving the faith, I picked up by his own hand upon on papyrus, and you know I read that from cover to cover, and you know I knew you know the basic tenets of what was in it before I had read it, but you know reading it and seeing it right there in front of me in you know graphic detail, it drove it directly home to me, and from that you know my leaving the church was cemented.
Yeah, that's a very good introduction to the issues, by the way. If anybody is interested in looking at these issues more deeply, Larson has all kinds of great color photographs. He's got this color foldout that arranges all the papyri in the way they would originally have been. One of the more sort of useful introductions to the issues, I think, although he doesn't get everything right.
Yeah, I remember sitting in state conference, and I actually brought it with me to state conference. And one of my friends who was, you know, thought of himself as an apologist was looking over to me kind of squirrely-eyed going, what are you doing? You know, and I'm like giving him the thumbs up and, you know, kind of passing him the book. And he's, you'd think that I brought a hustler into there or something, you know.
You didn't get struck down right then, Jim? That's amazing.
No, I didn't.
So, Chris,
even.
Yeah.
By his own hand is often recommended, which Charles Larson takes a rather negative slant. Is there anything that you would recommend from an apologetic point of view that's accessible to the non-apologetic crowd?
That's an excellent question. I think that by far the best book written on this subject by a believing LDS author is H. Donnell Peterson's book, The Story of the Book of Abraham. But I can't think of an apologetic piece that really, I think, treats this well or responsibly. Kevin Barney certainly comes closest. He's got an essay out there, about the Semitic adaptation, the facsimiles of the Book of Abraham and Semitic adaptation. But, when it comes to, like, Nibley stuff or Yiddish stuff or Tibetanese, I just think that they have really gotten a lot of things wrong. They've really kind of messed up on this particular issue.
Yeah, I have Peterson's book sitting in front of me right now, and unfortunately it just ends right where all the interesting stuff starts.
It really doesn't go into the apologetic issues, the how to keep your faith issues.
I really appreciate, Chris, and you and your perspective, and it actually sounds like you're quite objective and not so judgmental. I don't think my straw man approach worked too well, but I think that, this is a problematic thing, but in all things religious and religion based, it all comes down to faith, you know, and whether you actually believe things. It's actually quite tough to actually prove and to cause someone's belief to go one way or the other. I mean, there is quite a bit of evidence, like you've stated, but you know, religion is an emotion driven thing. It's faith-based, and it's hard for people to actually shake that. And so the catalyst theory and the missing papyri theory, those things, if that's all that we have, then that's all you have, as long as your faith goes. So I really appreciate your input, Chris, and all you haters, so thank you.
So this is Jordan. Just to add to what Tom just mentioned, I would think if you took basically any of this information and shared it with a regular chapel attending person who, you know, just goes about the normal life in the church, I think you're basically going to hear from them, well, I believe in Joseph Smith, and I've received a testimony about the Book of Mormon, therefore all of this other stuff just falls into place, and I will find out the answer, you know, later on, and if Joseph Smith did something wrong, that's his problem, not mine. And I think there's this sense that, yeah, even if it ends up being a difficult thing to have long term as a knowledge base, a lot of times I think in the church people go more with their testimony about a person or a book, and everything else is just kind of put under the rug. And I think that's where you have problems. Is a way to deal with it when people start looking at it objectively and take off that one filter. And so I think what Chris has done here is a really good job. I agree. I think you've looked at it pretty objectively. I don't think you've got a big axe to grind. So I thank you for your work. Thanks for coming on today.
Thank you.
Okay, Chris, I know I'm left with a lot more questions, a lot of things I'd like to talk about, particularly the coming fourth of the manuscript in the 50s and 60s, and maybe we'll have to bring you back on in the future to discuss that.
Yeah, that is an interesting story there, too, so look forward to it. Thanks,
right.
John.
Thanks, everybody on the panel, for their participation. You can find a link to Chris's blog, which has some of his writings on the Book of Abraham, on our website. Remember, the discussion continues at MormonExpression.com. Check out the blog there for links to the information discussed. And to continue the discussion, you can call and leave a message for us to play on the podcast. Our number is 801-906-6722. Or you can email us your comments or audio for future podcasts to mail@MormonExpression.com. Our music is provided by Kevin McLeod at Incompetech.com. Thanks again. Chris, start again and say latter half of the 19th century.
Latter half of the 19th century.
Say it one more time.
Latter half of the 19th century.
Perfect.